ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Previous exhibitions at the Bendigo Art Gallery, our favourite gallery here on Overnights, have highlighted individuals: Elvis, Grace Kelly, Mary Quant, Edith Head, Marilyn Monroe. But the show on at the moment looks at an entire city at a pivotal moment in its history, Paris, between 1880 and 1925. The display mixes paintings, clothes, posters, maps, furniture, statues, and even a pair of oversized snails. Claire Needham is the curator, and Claire, welcome to Overnights.
Great to be here. Thanks, Rod.
Thank you very much. What happened in Paris between 1880 and 1925? Why those 2 years?
So it's a really fascinating time in the story of Paris. So it's just after Baron Haussmann, Napoleon III, had radically redesigned the city with grand boulevards and really changing the design and character of the city. France had just lost to the Germans in the Franco-Prussian War, and they'd been the commune, a huge sort of, moment in the story of Paris, and this civil unrest that had caused a lot of devastation and bloodshed. And so it was, I guess, a time of sort of reckoning for Paris as well. But at the same time, there was all of this technological innovation, all of this social change, and it was a time also when artists were really pushing the sort of boundaries of what had been acceptable in the traditional salons, taking their canvases outside and capturing the sort of bustle of the sort of modernized city. So modernism was really sort of surging and coming forth. And as the sort of 19th century turned to the 20th, Paris really emerged as this vibrant modern city, really sort of encapsulating a lot of those ideas of progress and really drew the spotlight of the world as well through, huge big universal exhibitions and actively sort of courting the attention of the world and really moving forward in terms of fashion, art and design as well.
Kind of asserting itself as the centre of the world, which kind of had been London prior to that, but now it was Paris.
Well, yeah, I mean, Paris was the second most densely populated city in Europe at the time, second to London. So it definitely did have sort of lots of comparative and similar parts. And also Napoleon III really looked to London in terms of garden design. And we've got a really great section in the exhibition that really explores that idea of the green open space being a huge component of that redesign of the city to really sort of combat lots of health concerns around tuberculosis and, the sort of things that come with a very industrial, busy city.
Yes, so it wasn't just the artists who were working on plein air, as it were. They wanted the people of the city to go out and experience the fresh air of Paris.
Absolutely, yeah. And there was, a real growing sort of urban middle class that were much more affluent. There was a lot of imperial pursuits that France was taking on at that time also, and the Second Industrial Revolution was really bringing about more leisure time and more financial means for people. And so a whole lot of different forms of entertainment really emerged, and there was definitely spaces and for that sort of leisure activity to take place as well, given that these sort of redeveloped gardens, the Bois de Boulogne, the Jardin of Luxembourg, spaces where people could play sport and, have picnics and go on boat rides, lots of games for children to play. And in this section of the exhibition, we also have these incredible haute couture garments from the National Gallery of Victoria and the National Gallery of Australia's collection, which show the kind of fashions that would have also been worn at the time. And a walk in the garden or a visit to the races, which were quite popular at the time, would have been an opportunity to really be seen or see the latest fashions as well.
I mean, nothing has changed in that regard, has it, really? That's why people go to the races these days. Most of them never see a horse. There was a growing middle class in Paris, and a growing middle class has changed the world in so many countries. How did the lives of the middle class change in Paris in that time?
Well, the first section of the exhibition really looks at the idea of consumerism, which was a really huge growth area in terms of the, I mentioned before about, a growing sort of affluence in that middle class and time and means to be able to, shop and wear the different sort of fashions that were coming out at the time and pursue those leisure pursuits. And shops really, therefore, sort of pioneered and utilised these great new technologies and promotional tools, advertising the whatever their goods and services were. So street advertising, really vibrant, bright posters and typography, you know, really emerged as a popular art form, but also as a means to draw attention of people to come and shop at your shop. Yeah. But also fabulous street signs, which you mentioned in your intro about the two oversized snails. We've got some incredible street signs in the exhibition, which are a really distinct element within the collection of the Musée Carnavalet, which is where all of these items come from to Bendigo, which would have been a locator within the city for a particular shop, also helping people before street signs to navigate their way around the city, and also acted as a, you know, a sort of advertising tool as well for the shop.
Just back to the middle class, though. I mean, many of them are actually working in these shops, aren't they? So they're kind of in service to the wealthy in shops. These retail outlets, these shops were hugely important in the way that the city developed, that people then had shopping as a leisure activity.
That's right. And the department store also really came into its own at this period of time. And so you have, you know, many products available for sale, you know, the kind of the novelty of coming to shop at the department store where you've got a you know array of things for sale, but also a different experience of shopping as well, you know, which really sort of unsettled the local ecosystems of specialty shops and other sort of local market areas as well.
Yeah. And the Galeries Lafayette, which is a department store in Paris, is still, it's a tourist attraction. People go to Paris to go to the Galeries Lafayette. How extensive, how big were these department stores in Paris?
Well, there were key department stores across the city, and some of the ones which are we have incredible advertising posters for within the city. You know, as far as I understand, they were quite big for the time, given that we're talking about sort of specialty shops before this time and local shops, and then you're getting sort of bigger. I'm not sure if they're as big as department stores today, but they certainly at the time would have been quite a revolution.
And quite something to go into a shop and see all these things displayed rather than having to go from shop to shop. The exhibition kind of concludes in 1925, which is essentially 100 years ago. It seems like a long, long time ago, but how much was life in those days like it is these days, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure so much about life. I guess our contemporary lives would be quite different to the modern life. However, this really was a time when the shape of Paris, as we know it today, sort of physically in terms of its design and character, you know, the large boulevards had been put in, built in at this time, and, you know, a lot of those sort of advertising mechanisms and department stores and sort of commercial mechanisms were really built in. Large windows were put into the bottom floor of those shops and buildings along those large boulevards, you know, allowing for shops to create enticing window displays and, you know, consider the both the interior of their store and also the exterior of the store to catch people's attention on the street. You know, some of those sort of progressive ideals and social changes that happened to really sort of shift a lot of those very heavily classed sort of attitudes, but also expectations as well, were really sort of shaken up during this time. So a lot of our sense of Paris today was really shaped at this time. So, you know, in terms of the kind of influence that this time had on the sort of sense of Paris, both for Parisians and the French, but also for within the global imagination, you know, and in pop culture as it sort of continues to be thought about. These sort of mythologies and romanticised visions of Paris certainly can be drawn back to this time.
Absolutely. Paris Impressions of Life, 1880 to 1925, is on at the Bendigo Art Gallery at the moment. Claire Needham is talking about it this morning. The exhibition is not done chronologically. It doesn't start in 1880 and finish in 1925, but it has these different themes. What are they?
The themes really give a sense of a journey through the streets of Paris at this time. So taking visitors from the busy marketplaces to the grand boulevards lined with retail shops to the parks and gardens that were developed and, you know, really shaped and honed at that time, along the banks of the Seine to the Eiffel Tower, you know, to the lively cabaret and theatre venues of Montmartre, and then through to the one of the most iconic avenues of Paris, the Champs-Élysées.
1889 is the World's Fair and the Eiffel Tower. How did that quite literally change the landscape of Paris, that people were able to go up to the top and see their city spread out before them? They'd never been able to do that before, but also that it gave a landmark to Paris that perhaps it didn't have before, that people came from around the world to see. And the amazing thing is they wanted to tear it down after a couple of years. How come it stayed? Why is it so important?
Well, yeah, it's a fascinating story, actually. It's an incredible feat of engineering. You can imagine at the time the sort of the ability to get something that high out of the ground would have been incredible, but also just the sort of be able to see the structure of it as well. You know, there was a lot of commentary at the time that it was an eyesore, that it was, you know, physically unattractive, but also it was unsafe. And there was, you know, as you can imagine, lots of conversation in the press and other sort of platforms where people would talk about the Eiffel Tower. But it quickly became this presentation or this sort of icon of the excitement for Paris at this time, and it was made into souvenirs very quickly, and we have quite a few of those on display in the exhibition, which was then, you know, spread this idea of this powerful image of Paris and France across the world. But the Gustave Eiffel, who was a big part of funding and building the tower, really, I think, did a good job in promoting the tower and invited a lot of... He had an apartment at the top floor, which if you go today and head up the tower, you can still see the apartment there. Yeah, and he would host diplomats and, you know, influential people to come and see and have that spectacular view across the city, and to really sort of, I guess, shift people's perception and really build a love of the tower, which then was so good that the lease that Eiffel had on the land was renewed, because he had a short time for the tower to be there and then it was going to be taken down. But then, of course, it's so embedded now in the idea of Paris that it's still there today. And it was also a real hub of scientific research, which was a really key part in why it also was able to stay there and how it survived, in that it was a place where there was a lot of experiments around sort of weather and aerodynamics, and, you know, people were able to get to this incredible height they'd never been able to get to before, and really sort of test the limits of the structure itself and different forms of engineering and scientific research.
It is such a beautiful building. Why anyone would see it as an eyesore, I just don't know. And you're right, when you go up to the top these days, there is Eiffel. There's a model of him, a mannequin, taking tea with Thomas Edison. It's bizarre, to say the least. But it is such a beautiful thing. And even to this day, except for the kind of small CBD, you might call, of Paris, the Eiffel Tower is the tallest building. There is nothing that even remotely comes near being the same height in that area of Paris. It still stands out, and Paris has done a brilliant job at preserving the way it would have looked in 1889, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. That's right. And I would say it would have had a fairly strong influence on, therefore, the Seine as well, and the shape, the sort of structure of the Seine. And yep. In the exhibition, we have this incredible suite of paintings in the Seine section, which, you know, really capture the everyday life on the Seine, of the industry and the trade and the commerce, things that aren't as prevalent today on the banks of the Seine. You know, today they're UNESCO heritage listed for their historical but also picturesque quality. And you can see lots of incredible monuments and icons of the story of the history of Paris along the Seine. But there's been a lot of work to sort of take a lot of that industry out of the city and preserve that sort of picturesque quality of the Seine, of which the Eiffel Tower is a showpiece.
It sure is. And when you're walking along the banks of the river, sometimes, you know, you're on the river, maybe you're on a boat, and you go around the corner and there it is. There is the Eiffel Tower, this incredibly recognisable structure. There it is right in front of you, and it is awe-inspiring. It doesn't matter how many times you see it. It always looks so absolutely splendid, and it's just something about it. The mix of the tower, the river, everybody gathered around it. Of course, there's always thousands of people there. It is a really remarkable tower, isn't it? Did you go to the top?
We did go to the top, yes. It was important research for the exhibition.
I'll bet, yeah. Especially the champagne that you have at the top as well.
Not quite. We didn't get the champagne, but we certainly got a little medal, which is a souvenir when you get to the top if you'd like to put a couple of euro in the machine and get a little medal. Because actually in the exhibition itself, we also have one of the original medals that was very quickly created because it was such an excitement. Mm. There were millions of people that were visiting the Eiffel Tower in its, you know, first year of being in Paris. And so it was quite a feat to get to the top. The lifts came in very early, which is also incredible in terms of an engineering feat, to be able to have the lifts so early on to be able to get people right to the top. There was also in the exhibition a plate that commemorates if you could walk the 625 stairs to the second floor, but many more to the top. But it certainly became sort of a site, I guess, of both the scientific research and the excitement of the progress and the engineering and the technological innovation of the era, but also a social space. You know, there were restaurants and other things that were quickly implemented into the different floors of the tower too.
Claire Needham is our guest from Bendigo Art Gallery, and we're talking about the extraordinary exhibition, Paris Impressions of Life, 1880-1925. What we've mostly talked about, though, is what happens during the daytime. Now, it is great to go up the Eiffel Tower at night. That's fantastic. But there are all sorts of things going on at night, and there are a couple of sections in the exhibition about the nightlife of Paris, aren't there? What have you got there?
Yeah, so we've sort of taken you through and in what we've talked about so far of the markets and the, you know, bustling sort of retail strips through the parks along the Seine. And then in the exhibition, you'll come to this big moment with the Eiffel Tower, and we sort of look at the layers and layers of the story of the Eiffel Tower. And then we head into, from the day to the night, to the heady bohemian life in Montmartre, which is, you know, just north of the Seine, and also a little bit of the theatre district as well, that's just a little bit south of Montmartre, that whole area where there was a lot of experimentation and a lot of sort of adventurous avant-garde activity going on in that area.
You know, when we were there and we walked through the exhibition, you talked about this painting. They've showed us this painting of a student ball. Now, this ball lasted for decades until, I don't know why they finished it up. When was it? The 70s, 60s or 70s, I think.
Yeah.
Just describe that painting, because it is a remarkable one, and it is a side of life that we just don't see anymore.
So it's a really incredible painting by Louis Abel Triquet, and it's a very vibrant sort of wild party scene with lots of theatrics and costumes. And as you mentioned, it depicts a student ball. So the art students of the city would put together this ball every year that was themed around a different theme. And this particular ball was themed around the theme of all of antiquity except for Rome. And so you've got these sort of sculptural elements and decorative elements that reference lots of different periods in antiquity. And then you've got costumes and all sorts of riotous behaviour going on. And this piece, this painting, has just been acquired into the collection of the Musée Carnavalet. And this is actually the first time it's been put on display since it's come into the collection. So we're really honoured to be able to have this piece on display, and it's huge and very evocative. And the ball would take place, and then around about midnight the doors would be locked and they wouldn't be open again until about 7 in the morning. And who knows what took place while the doors were closed?
Well, we can guess by looking at this picture, because I find it interesting that they say nothing from ancient Rome is allowed, because this is a bacchanalia, if ever there was one. There are all sorts of things going on in this painting.
There are. There's, yeah, lots of frivolity and fun and colour and
riotous
atmosphere.
Behaviour.
Riotous behaviour is definitely a good way to describe it.
And then they'd spill out onto the street at 6 o'clock in the morning.
That's right, and parade themselves in their costumes through the city. It would have been quite a spectacle.
Yeah.
And quite a contrast also to the village life of Montmartre. So Montmartre wasn't actually annexed into the city of Paris until 1860. And so it was very much a village area until around the 1880s, when some of those boulevards were put in and apartment buildings were built. And so there was this change as well that took place in Montmartre. And then, of course, the Sacré-Cœur was built as well at that turn of the century time, which really shifted and changed the character of Montmartre. And it was also, you know, an area where a lot of the city's, real poor communities lived. And so it was really a kind of space of this excitement and thrill and pleasure seeking, but also, you know, the sort of poorest of the poor in the city.
Moulin Rouge, for example, that is in the Montmartre area. That's the sort of place that it sort of is these days. It's a bit scruffy, a bit dirty in parts, not quite like the genteel areas of some other parts of the city. One of the great things, I think, about the exhibition is obviously the number of artworks, because as I mentioned before, it's not just paintings. There's a whole lot of other things in the exhibition. And the artworks are by artists that perhaps you may not know, but were obviously working there at the time. And that gives you an idea of really the number of artists that must have been working in Paris in the late 19th century, early 20th century.
Absolutely. And the great thing also about the 45-year span of the exhibition is that it's a really great way to see across the whole exhibition the way that painting in particular really developed across that 45-year span. So it's, you know, just after the Impressionists are really pushing the boundaries of the academy and what's sort of acceptable to be painting, what sort of subject matter you might choose to paint, taking the canvases out into the streets or everyday life in Paris and in France, painting the Seine, painting the gardens, painting the bustling streets, you know, really trying to capture that sort of modern, the life, the energy of modern life, and those sort of atmospheric qualities of fleeting moments. So looking at the way that light and colour and reflection and changes in weather and changes sort of from morning to night could be captured in paint. And it was that sort of change that took place in that moment also then evolved and changed as the 45-year period played out. So we've got works in the exhibition, sometimes of the exact same scene, but painted almost 40 years apart. And you really see the shift. So we've got this incredible piece by Stanislas Lépine, painted in 1880, looking at the Pont des Arts, looking back towards Notre Dame Cathedral. And then the same scene painted by Paul Signac, who was a post-impressionist and was really pushing sort of the different application of colour and pioneered this idea of pointillism, where you would put points of pure colour next to each other to create these dynamic effects. Same scene painted, you know, 40 years yeah. apart, really shows that what was happening at the time and how it was sort of spreading out across the artistic milieu, across the city.
Mm. You mentioned the exhibition finishes with the Champs-Élysées. These days it leads from the Arc de Triomphe all the way down to the Place de la Concorde, where Marie Antoinette was executed. There's a little plaque on the ground there to denote that. These days tourists and locals walk there because it's a great place to walk and you go past all the high-end shops. But it's always been like that, hasn't it? That's where people went to shop and went to be seen.
Absolutely, yes. So once those big grand boulevards went in, it really gained that sort of prominence. And it was really a place where the sort of private salons of the wealthy elite classes of Paris came outside to socialise and to, you know, enjoy the different leisure pursuits and different entertainments that were on offer. Restaurants and cafes sort of had that festive feeling about it. The Universal Exhibitions we talked about before, you know, also left the legacy of things like the Grand Palais and the Petit Palais on the Champs-Élysées as well. So, and big grand buildings and parks and gardens were also re-established and developed around that time as well. So it really created a sort of elegance and luxury that space is known for now.
Yeah, and the modern Paris that we know and love today really developed during this time, 1880 to 1925. The exhibition has come from the Musée Carnavalet in Paris. Just tell us a little bit about that and why is it so important, and why is it, do you think, that it's a museum that's often overlooked?
It's such a fascinating museum. I think it really is the place that people should go to first when they go to Paris. It is the Museum of the History of Paris. So it looks at the story of the city all the way from prehistory to the present day. It's actually one of the pathways in the exhibition itself is the museum, because it was established around the same period of the focus period of the exhibition. So in 1866, when Haussmann was doing a lot of the renovating of the city and, you know, really changing the character and design, also had the foresight to create a museum. So he had the idea to put together a collection of items and pieces that were gifted to the museum and actively purchased also by the government to tell the story of Paris and to remember the past as it was changing. And then since then has carried on the same idea of building its collection around the stories of the city of Paris and the people of Paris. And they have an absolutely incredible array, almost 600,000 objects in their collection. And for this exhibition, we've been able to work together in collaboration with the museum to bring items from their collection, which really show that breadth. So everything, like you mentioned before, from paintings to posters to everyday ephemera to, you know, their unique collection of street signs from the streets of Paris, giant snails.
I mean, we shouldn't go without saying that this is the only place in Australia you will see two giant golden snails. The exhibition is on until the 14th of July, which is a significant date. That's Bastille Day. And so people have got plenty of time to get there, but don't wait too long. You wouldn't want to miss out. It's a fabulous place to visit. Everyone's saying bonjour in Bendigo as part of it. Once again, the entire city is getting behind what the art gallery is doing. And it's such a fabulous place to visit, and it's such a great exhibition. And Claire, look, congratulations on what you've brought to it. And, you know, I'm sure you're going to be enjoying the next few months, aren't you?
Absolutely. Look, it's the first time that the Musée Carnavalet has ever worked with putting together an exhibition for an international venue. So this is the first time the collection has been seen in Australia, and we're incredibly proud to be able to create this experience of Paris in Bendigo for visitors to come and enjoy.
But how many times do we hear, oh, this is the first time that a museum has worked with an Australian museum, and it's always with Bendigo? That tells you something as well. Claire, thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.